This is another episode of Connecting the Dots podcast. I'm Skip Stewart, Vice President and Chief Improvement Officer at Baptist Memorial Healthcare.
Hey, everybody. I'm H.F. Mason. I'm a General Surgeon and Chief Quality Officer for the Baptist System.
And I'm Brad Parsons, Vice President of Market Operations for Baptist.
Well, folks, today we have a wonderful guest, Dave Garrison. And Dave's going to be talking about his new book. You've probably heard about it all over the internet and on LinkedIn. The buy-in advantage, the buy-in advantage. Before we jump right into that conversation, Dave, if you would tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and about your background.
So, Skip, I am by nature somebody who's incredibly curious, and I am a sponge for learning. And I've had the opportunity to both be a public company and a private company CEO. I've been on the board of nonprofit organizations in Mississippi, from Habitat to Humanity to an art museum to, I've done the gamut in terms of experiences with teams and groups of people. And what I've learned along the way is as much from my own mistakes as amazing things other people do. And what I recognized is, it's no secret, there's a buy-in crisis occurring now, which we'll talk about in the workplace, which actually, because you're Baptist medical centers and management system, I'd call out as a mental health crisis as well that's going on, that is very real, and it is a shameful waste of human potential. After I concluded a couple of decades as a CEO, I became a consultant to leadership teams and a coach to leaders in order to help achieve full potential of the amazing human beings that work on their teams. So I have the privilege of working with people around the world, mostly in the US, around the world, in all different industries and all different businesses, about how do we get the best from the people we work with without having to badger them or yell at them or demand more or say, how come you're not doing what I asked? And so I have a degree in accounting, which is interesting. It gives me some cred in business. I have an MBA from Harvard Business School, and it's where I learned how to ask a lot of questions. And I have a life worth of experience, amazing wife, two kids, born in Jackson, Mississippi, in one of your market areas.
How about that?
I'm excited to be here. So thank you.
Well, Dave, it's great to make that connection. I went to medical school in Jackson, Mississippi. I'm a Mississippi native, went to Ole Miss. And I know you went to Syracuse for undergrad. And when I was at Ole Miss, I didn't watch a lot of Big East basketball, but Ronnie Cicely, I watched him all the time, and he was one of my favorite players back in the day. And once again, thank you for being here. You know, I was intrigued by your book, The Buy-In Advantage, and the subtitle says Why Employees Stop Caring and How Great Leaders Inspire Everyone to Give Their All. And, you know, here at Baptist, we talk about engagement. Is engagement and buy-in, are they synonymous? And unpack that a little bit for us. And what exactly do you mean by buy-in?
Yeah, HF, that's a great question. So Gallup organization is considered the gold standard of measuring what's called engagement. And their gold standard question is, would you recommend this as a place to friends, trusted ones, as some place to work? Would you recommend this? And the sad truth is, we're at the lowest rating in a decade. And in a good year in America, it's been 30% of the people saying, yeah, a net percentage, 31 in three saying, yeah, I'd recommend this as a place to work. So engagement in my world of literal definitions is how people would answer the question, would you recommend this as a place to work? The answer is pathetic. We have a leadership crisis that's occurred. It is not leaders' fault necessarily, but leaders have the opportunity to get us out of this crisis. And it's not, well, people are lazy, or it's this generation, or all these other excuses I hear, because they said that about our parents' generation, said that about us. So let's get over that and let's move on. I would point out that buy-in in my world is when people voluntarily bring their brains, their hearts, and their guts. They bring their full selves to work. So think about the difference. HF, you mentioned Ole Miss. Think about the difference of the enthusiasm you see in the stadium at Ole Miss or at Tennessee. And think about Friday night football games on a local level. And I'd ask you, which of those adults in the Friday night football game stadiums bring the same level of themselves to work on Monday morning or to the factory floor?
Very few.
I'd say very few. Do we invite them in? How would results be different if we had fully formed human beings that were invited to bring in their hearts and their minds and their guts to make things happen, to do great things? And that's the human potential that we're missing. So there's a slight difference between engagement and buy-in, but the idea is people are all in, and the reality is they are not.
Yeah, Dave, that's a great start. You know, we're kind of a unique organization where we have a strong faith-based mission, and it really helps us create purpose. So I want to ask you a question about how to really have a compelling purpose, but also want to admit that HF said it, but we have a strong engagement culture, and we do have actually much better results than average in engagement. But I think I'm really curious about continuing the thread of like, how do we capitalize on purpose, and how do we really move from maybe from just engagement to a higher form of engagement, of buy-in? So can you share a little bit there?
Yeah, Brad, I can. And first of all, I would call out that most healthcare organizations attract people who are empathetic, and your organization has the benefit of not only empathetic, but also being faith-based and having purpose, serving a higher purpose in what you are doing. And that's amazing. And the opportunity is, how do you use that compelling purpose when you interview people? How do you use that compelling purpose when you make decisions? Every single decision, not just in the what they call the suits, you know, not just the suits, but the real people doing the work. How do they use the compelling purpose? How are they taught to use that purpose in making decisions? How do we use it in reinforcing choices that people make to call out and celebrate? So is it something on the wall, or is compelling purpose something I would hear every day? And could I go up to the employee on their first day in the ER and say, hey, can you just, what's this all about? Why is this work worth doing? Which is, it's always about a higher purpose. And that compelling purpose is 4 to 6 words, and everybody knows it and they use it daily. So putting compelling purpose to work in the interview, it's, hey, I want to share with you our compelling purpose. How do you see yourself in that? How can you, based on who you are, how would you contribute to that compelling purpose? And we want to see if people line up, because one thing about this generation, which is not your generation or my generation, is that money is important. Of course it is. And people will tell you they leave for a better job and more money, and that's usually total bogus. But what is important is compelling purpose, opportunity to grow personally and professionally, an opportunity to have their voice heard, to have their opinion count. When those three conditions are not present, people will leave for the same wage and come to you and say, hey, I got a better job. And so how do you have your voice heard? Now, I'll tell you, there's a story that didn't make the book, but as an example in healthcare, for example. So it's not a for-profit. It's a nonprofit hospital. It's a regional hospital. Got an edict from corporate headquarters. I know this would never happen in your organization, but they got an edict saying, hey, we need to increase the number of beds per nurse. And the administrator came in and said, hey, you know what? Starting next Monday, we need to increase the number of beds per nurse, and the new ratio is going to be whatever it's going to be.
We've never heard that, have we?
I know. And, you know, we got a message from corporate. We need to cut costs. So here's what we're going to do. And that's awesome. Here's the challenge. They lost about 25% of their nursing staff who were never asked, how could we accomplish that? What would the unintended consequences be? And what are alternate ways to achieve the cost savings? They were not considered. They walked with their feet. The result for that hospital was they ended up hiring traveling nurses at a significantly higher expense. So instead of cutting costs, the unintended consequences was raising costs when they could have practiced, how can we include people in tough decisions we need to make? And we call that in the book, doing with, not doing to. Mm-hmm. So doing with is an important principle of buy-in.
Yeah, no, I love that concept of doing with instead of doing to. I mean, you know, we've talked about this several times. We've got similar things, you know, from kind of top down, old school to more of a collaborative leadership style. And but I like the way you coined that in the book, doing with instead of doing to, really resonates. I want to go back to voice counts.
Yeah,
I like that a lot too. But what does that mean?
Yeah. So some people would say, particularly old school people would say, wait a minute, I'm the one with the experience around here. I've earned the right to this office and I'm going to tell you how it is. And you're welcome to use your position and title and tell people how it is. And you're going to have people check out. The cost to the organization is enormous because, you know, it's hard for me to remember as a CEO. It's hard to remember that what I see is not really what's there. And what I mean by that is, you know, as a pilot, I've got a blind spot. I got a huge blind spot behind me. I have the benefit of having informed decisions based on all of my experience and all of my knowledge and all of my training. And I only see one little perspective. And it's hard for me to realize that's just my perspective. It's not the truth. It's just how I happen to see things. But Brad, you've been down a different set of experiences. You have different training, different education. We can all look at the same data and see things differently. If we remember to say, look, this is just my story, how I see the data. I'm really curious, what are other ways to see it? And from getting other perspectives, we can cover our own blind spot. So this is actually a really important strategy for getting best results, is to ask others what meaning they make of the same data. What meaning they make of the same data.
Yeah.
And so that's listening to voice, as also when we make decisions that affect people, like those nurses I gave you the example of. Hey, look, we need to reduce costs. The decision's been made. How can we minimize the impact on patients? How can we minimize the impact on us as professionals in making this change? What should we consider doing differently? What's this mean to us? If the administrator had simply asked that question up front, people would have felt, oh, my voice counts.
Yeah, and it really goes to culture too, Dave. I mean, a big piece of this. So how do you, but again, I think what I'm also learning is every time we say a buzzword like culture, I've got a definition in my head. Your definition may be different. So yeah. So what? How do you define culture?
So I'll give you a really simple, it's a little bit of a wise A answer, but it's when I join your organization, it's the answer to the question when I ask the person next to me what it's like to work here. It's the Friday night party where people go to a beer blast and they go, hey, what's it like over there? Whatever they say, that is your culture. It's not what's on the poster in the wall. And what I would ask any organization leader is, how much money do you put into the training of your leaders in how we create the culture? Which is different than saying, this is the culture we want. We want a culture that's caring and we want a culture that's this and that. Okay, that's awesome. Tell me what the tools are I have to put that into practice day to day when I've got a high workload. I've got a lot of pressure on decision making. I've got a lot going on. I'm not looking for stuff to do. I appreciate all this theory coming out of Memphis, but I got a job to do. And that's where reality meets culture.
Great answer.
Dave, go ahead, Skip. I know you.
Well, I just had a quick question. You know, one of the things I'd love to hear your response on, Dave, is that a lot of times when you hear people talk about leadership and developing teams and getting this buy-in, it feels as if they're talking about it as an episodic event. And they did one special event, one special thing. But yeah. I remember having a wise man tell me 30 plus years ago, don't ever stop dating your wife. Yeah. And I think there's a lot of taking that same truth with leading teams, right? What today is today, and it won't be what tomorrow is like. And so there has to be this constant feeding that relationship. Am I thinking about that correctly?
Oh, so true. So three different aspects of that come to mind. One is I was sitting with the CEO of one of the top tourist attractions in America. And I said, you know, a lot of companies just will put out their corporate objectives or put up their values, and then they'll talk about it in a town hall, and it's kind of one and done. And it takes adults, it's said, about 7 times to absorb stuff into their bones. So until your team members say to you, Skip, quit talking about the objectives for this quarter, or quit talking about this program, until you hear people say that, you haven't said it enough. So that's part of that repetition. However, sustaining values well beyond this year's objectives or this quarter or this measurement or this new program or, you know, this new government regulation, appreciation and vulnerability are two of the traits that have to be in our bones and authentic. You cannot fake your appreciation of people. And if you say to people, for example, good job, that's not appreciation of people. That's like putting a quarter in the slot and the peanuts drop out the bottom. You know, it's good job. It makes me wonder, do you know what I actually do? What are you referring to? I've just done 100 things in this week, and you come by and say, good job. And you said that to everybody. So appreciation is truly calling out one specific behavior and tying it to our compelling vision or to a corporate value to say, you know what, when you went above and beyond and you had to stay past your shift to provide this outstanding care to a family, not the patient, but the patient's family, it really demonstrated our value of fill in the blank. That's different than good job. So appreciation sustains. The other thing is being vulnerable. So we'll say in the book, The Buy-In Advantage, leaders go last. So when a question is asked, even if you're asking the question, you zip it. You go last. However, leaders go first in vulnerability, in saying things like, I don't know, or I'm really struggling with this. And leaders who are vulnerable and lead with vulnerability give everyone else an invitation to be vulnerable as well. And where that shows up, as you know, particularly in healthcare, where that shows up is that we are, unless we have that vulnerability demonstrated by leaders, lives are at risk because people are trained to say, did you understand what I mean? You know, here are the instructions. Yeah, I got it. Well, we don't know if they got it or not. We have no clue because we think we're a brilliant person at communication. We think they got it. Of course they did because I did a great job explaining. We have no idea what they heard unless we check back in to say, you know what? Sometimes I'm not always clear. To make sure, because this is an important procedure, whatever, can we just verify what it is that you heard me say so I know I'm clear? And HF, I'm curious from your years of surgery if that resonates at all, because that's a high-pressure, precise environment where lives are on the line.
Yeah, it does. It absolutely does. And Dave, you know, a lot of times we think, and I think we think incorrectly, is that, you know, leaders are born and not made. And there is some truth to it. There are people out there who are naturally dynamic. They're charismatic. And leadership comes to them much, much more easily than it does to others. But in your book, I mean, you say these are skills and these are steps that leaders can take to become better leaders. And talk to us a little bit about that, because that's what we're about here. We're all about learning skills, practice, and you know, I think a lot of people think, well, I'm not a natural leader, so you know that doesn't apply to me. But your book begs to differ.
Do you know? I think it's a great question. And HF, it's interesting you use the words dynamic and charismatic to describe what many people think a leader is. And I would argue that those are two wonderful qualities for a leader and absolutely unnecessary. If I have a person who is authentic and clear and consistent, somebody who appreciates and is deeply curious about the human condition and how to get better results, how to support you more, I would argue I'd take that person, authentic, clear, consistent, appreciative, vulnerable, over a person who's dynamic and charismatic. Nothing wrong with being dynamic. I love that. Nothing wrong with being charismatic.
Yeah, Dave, that's really, really good. And again, because how many times do we go to the dynamic personality? I mean, you see it all the time. I mean, where those people are really, it's easy to point them out, maybe more so than the person that is curious.
Yeah.
Dave, do you see that changing in leadership?
I do. And the way it's changing is sort of like the Darwinian law, because leaders who cannot generate extraordinary results from cultures are replaced quickly. And the leaders who stick are the leaders who recognize, look, one, I don't have all the answers. Two, we're going to make a plan. It may or may not be right because the situation is going to change, but we're going to equip everybody they need with the permission and the tools to call out when we need to make a plan change or to spot an opportunity. And so it is changing, and it's changing because organizations are under tremendous pressure to produce results without just hiring more people.
You know, I want to go back to another word you use. You said clear and concise. So you talk about clarity versus certainty. Talk about how we show up with that and what that really looks like. Again, I really feel like that in a lot of organizations that we're just moving past, like we're moving on to the next thing. Some call it the flavor of the month. Some call it whatever initiative, whatever project. But to me, there we miss the opportunity for real clarity when we're jumping around like that. Will you share some of your experience there?
Two companies come to mind. One of them in New York that I interviewed two levels down from the CEO, and it's a company of probably, I don't know, 800, 1,200 people. And I said, what's it like? And they said, oh, I'll tell you. We have all these objectives that we agreed to, or we are actually told to. And then the CEO keeps coming up with these other ideas. And then my boss has other ideas. And I've got a list of about 20 priorities at any one time. Here's the dealio. I don't know which one's really a priority, because we talk in the book, 3 is greater than 7. Here's new math. 3 is greater than 7. Because if you've got 20 priorities, you have 0 priorities. And what these group of leaders told me was, I pray that I'm not going to be called on by my boss about priority number 7, and that's not the one I picked to do. And if I have 20, I can't complete any of them. So I feel like all my effort is going to naught. So highly effective organizations we talk about in the buy-in advantage are those that have a few priorities, are very clear because they're co-created, are very clear on how they're measured, which includes evidence. It's not just smart, also includes the activity and evidence and purpose of that objective, and then sticks with them until the end of the period, like a quarter or a year. And then, importantly, then does a learning loop. What did we learn about the setting of priorities? Was it the right scope? Was it expressed correctly? What did it turn out that this was totally the wrong thing to be doing, or we made a bad assumption? And that learning loop is where we develop that muscle to predict. And the more people we can include in that, the more layers of the organization, the more successful that we will be. So that clarity is about co-creation of prioritization that we stick to, where 3 is greater than 7. And then we're willing to be vulnerable and learn from, that was absolutely the wrong priority. What were we thinking? But that's the learning, as opposed to, yeah, well, that was a good idea. Let's create some new ones.
Yeah, that's right. Well, look, I got to brag on really Skip and HF and our boss, Chris Anderson, who's really championed this for us. And I've been on several calls with these guys even today. I mean, he just summarized our experience with our quality scorecard for the year, right? And so it's been refreshing to believe that 3 is greater than 7. And that's been almost our mantra. I might borrow that because I really like it.
Yeah,
we haven't used it verbatim, but I really like the thinking to, ruthlessly prioritize what are the things that we believe are going to have the biggest impact, because we got so many stakeholders and aligning all those stakeholders across different markets and different, levels of the organization and different skill sets. Is really, really hard work. And
it is takes, hard work.
Yeah, clarity and being concise to help deliver that message.
It takes and guts to say, no, we're not going to prioritize
that. Exactly. And I think one of the things that we do is that we don't do a good enough job of not only prioritizing, but in order to do that, we have to remove things off people's plates.
Yes.
You know, because I think one of the big obstacles is we have this strategy, but we were talking a little bit before you came on, Dave. It's almost like it's tacked on to the work that you're already doing,
and
people don't buy in because it just feels like another burden on them. Whereas if we were taking things off their plate and saying, no, we're not saying that's not important, but it's not important, the most important thing that we're working on right now.
And let's assist people in the art of delegation. Also, we talk about in the book about delegation. So we hear, oh, I'm overwhelmed. Okay, well, what's really important? Well, it's all important. Okay, well, it's all important. Who is it that can help you? Well, they don't really know how to do it the way I do. They're already burdened themselves and all these other excuses. And what you're doing is you're describing to me an organization that will stay stuck exactly where it is. If there's no time for priorities that would significantly improve the results of our organization, if you're not doing it as leaders, it's not happening. And if you're not cascading how to delegate, it's not happening.
Well, this is really good, Dave. And man, I can't believe we've kind of come near the end. But it did remind me once again that, you know, we had a friend of our organization's named Dr. Edgar Schein, and he would always have a saying about that life is a series of conversations and everything happens through conversations and relationships. And to get this buy-in that we so desire, we have to have conversations. We have to build relationships. People need to feel comfortable and safe speaking their mind, even if what they say maybe makes us uncomfortable sometimes. And so I think this work that you're doing, Dave, is just so important. I know that there's been a lot of buzz about the book. I've seen a lot of activity out on LinkedIn, people talking about it. And Dave, we're just so thankful for you willing to come to spend us a little bit of time. And on behalf of Baptist Memorial Healthcare, we're just so thankful for the work you're doing. And thank you so much for spending a little bit of time with us today.
Skip, can I leave two thoughts?
Please,
thoughts for you. One is back to this 6 o'clock and what we can't see behind us. So we see the opportunity, and there's in chapter 3 of the book, there's an assessment for the team to take. We see the opportunity is just share the assessment with the team. You can go to buyinbook.com and download that piece for free and ask your team to complete it and then ask them what their experience is so you can learn about somebody else's experience and help cover up for your blind spots and show vulnerability. And the second thing is, when you have a great idea, please, please, please do not come into your team and say, hey, everybody, I got a great idea. Because if you've got the title of leader, if you're the boss person, if you tell them it's a great idea, what are they going to say?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Hey, great idea, boss. It's not going to help you. It's not going to help them. However, it is a great idea in your experience because you're thinking about a specific problem and you're thinking about, how do I know it's a great idea? Oh, because it, and then you have a checklist that you're going through in your head. So what great leaders do is instead of sharing their great idea, they will create buy-in by saying, you know, I've been thinking about this problem of error rate in paperwork, error rate in patient care, error rate in whatever. And I'm curious how we could really reduce that rate significantly. And a great solution would meet the criteria of something that is easily understood by everybody. It's trainable. It's something we can measure and whatever your other criteria is. I'd like you to go away and give some thought to what would be solutions you can come up with that would meet those criteria. Then a day or two or 3 days later, get together with a team and say, curious what you came up with. And all these ideas are going to come out because they're all thinking from the same place you are. And then you're going to learn a ton and you can share your experience. And I'll bet you your ideas will change as a result of what you hear. So that's
great,
awesome.
Great. That is awesome.
Great. Really good. Well, Dave, thank you so much for spending time with us. And thank you for just spending some of your valuable time. We hope that you'll come back and visit us again and kind of tell us what you've learned on this journey as this book is just at the beginning stages of being launched. We'd love to have you come back. And just thank you so much for everything you're doing, Dave.
HF, Brad, Skip, thank you. And I look forward to learning what you learned by applying these new principles. Take care, everybody.
Awesome. See you.